It's time for Driving Me Crazy, coming to you live from Beechtree Studios near beautiful Pinehurst, North Carolina. This is the only show where a husband and wife drive, talk cars and life, and still love one another each day. Here's John and Laurie. Or is it Laurie and John? Oh, take it away, you crazy kids.
Good morning, Hezzy. Good morning, beloved husband,
Good
Johnny.
Good morning.
I'll let you go
Good
first
morning.
Today.
I haven't done that in a long time. How are you, Hezzy? I understand you've had a little bit of rain.
Oh, a little bit of rain and heavy winds, and the winds are still here, but the rain has stopped. Thank goodness. We're happy campers now.
We had a lovely rain. I mean, stunningly lovely. Rained all night, good portion of the next day. Then it cleared off, and it was 47, I think Laurie said. I thought it was supposed to get down to 41 last night.
It did, actually, in the middle.
With a high of 72 today. So it is stunningly gorgeous outside.
You know, after the high heat that we had to withstand for 3 months nonstop down here, this is, I mean, normally I don't think we would sleep with our sliding bedroom doors wide open in 41 degree. But we did. We love it.
And we turned on the fire this morning and actually had a nice fire to have our coffee by.
Now, the operative word is turned on the fire.
No firewood carrying for this old boy.
And so let's just say that since this show is also about life, that Johnny and I went through an epiphany when we moved here to Pinehurst. And determined that we were tired of lugging wood, which we'd both done for over half a century.
Yeah, no kidding. Really.
And you know, sitting in front of a fire and throwing in paper and sometimes lighter fluid to hope that the wet wood would catch. So we have a gas fireplace, which all you do is you press this little button on this little switch, and it starts. And you can sit there in total heaven without feeling...
And it's a
stressed
beautiful
out.
Fire.
It
I mean,
is. It's
they've come a long way with the fire logs so that it actually really looks like wood and it really looks like a fire. And they've even managed to fix it so that you look like you have ashes underneath the wood.
Oh,
and
wow.
All. It's just, I mean, it's amazing. It's sort of like Christmas trees. You know, the fake Christmas trees now almost look completely real. They've come so far. Yeah.
Johnny was on the road running an errand just before we started the show, and he phoned me from the road and told me to turn off the fire.
I said if you were comfortable, I'll leave it on.
I know that. But the point is this, that you can turn off a fire instead of put out a fire. And as far as Christmas is concerned, we're getting very close to that time of year when Johnny's going to insist that we start putting up Christmas decorations, which is like on the 31st of October. And we had this debate about, we do have an artificial tree. And that was a big leap for me, because I spent 40 years literally traipsing into the woods and cutting down trees for Christmas.
And we had a live tree.
No, we've had live trees.
And the needles all come off,
and
they get all over
it. And then they get stuck in everything. And so we decided to get an artificial tree. And I guess we must have missed the live tree thing, honey, because we found out you could get these little icicles that smell like pine trees that you could stick on your artificial tree.
Yeah, we bought a tree right in that interim period when they went from looking like, you know, tinsel to looking like a tree. It's sort of half live and half artificial. But if you put enough decorations on it, you can fool anybody.
But the problem is that they come pre-strung with lights, and last year when we finally took the tree down, Johnny and our grandson, Danny, spent most of the day cutting off the tree lights.
Yeah, third of the lights had stopped working, so we got to start over again.
So we got to start from scratch.
But we do have a tree. We do have a tree.
Yes, we do. But I told Johnny I'd like to also get a real tree for the kitchen so that...
Because it has a hardwood floor, so we can sweep all the stuff up and throw it out.
And that way we still have the real essence of Christmas instead of the stuff that's got to hang on the tree that smells like... Anyway, we're talking today to today we're talking about the 2020 Santa Fe Limited all-wheel drive. And, Johnny, you're going to start because you wrote the review for Yonkers Tribune,
I can start filling the middle and end the thing. Because, I think it's back in 2008, maybe the fall of 2007, I got a 2008 Hyundai Santa Fe Limited, just very similar to this one from at least the designation standpoint. And and I'll talk about the engine in a minute. But anyway, I got this vehicle because I was traveling up and down. I'd been doing a lot of driving, and before that I'd had a Toyota Tacoma, four-door extended cab, four-door, very nice truck, but it had an open bed. Loved it, did a lot of things with it, and I was on this touring up and down the East Coast going to the outdoor shows because, as you know, I sell hunts all over the world as far as taking people bird hunting, wing shooting. And so I would go to these outdoor shows, and I would take televisions and brochures. I mean, all the stuff that you take when you're an exhibitor at these kinds of things. And I had the truck, and I could put things in the back seat that I didn't want to get wet, and then you put things in the back of the truck. And it was not easy to do. And because I knew that was going to be my life for a while, I decided to buy a covered vehicle. And of course, at about that time is when they didn't call them crossovers, but the more the crossover SUVs were really becoming popular. And I wound up buying a Hyundai Santa Fe. Good price, wonderful vehicle, good reviews, all those kind of things. And I put about 100,000 miles, in fact, I put over 100,000 miles on it, driving from Florida all the way to, let's see how far north, probably to Connecticut from Ocala, Florida, all the way to northern Connecticut to do a number of these outdoor shows. And, of course, you'd go and do one, and then there'd be another one. You'd go to that one. Then you wind up going back to Florida, and then a month later you go and you do two more, three more, and then you go back to Florida, and then you'd go to North Carolina, back to Florida. So it was that kind of driving. And I was really looking for a vehicle that was comfortable and I could drive long distances and not be worn out. The Santa Fe was, and I'm not kidding you, it was the perfect vehicle. It was, back then you could adjust the seats, it was still electric, but you could adjust the seats a number of ways. And once you got it set up and got in, set it on cruise control, didn't have all the safety features that we have now, but you set it on cruise control, and it was 95. I mean, you know how 95 is. It runs from Florida all the way up through New York and north. So basically, once you got on 95, you just set the cruise control, and away you went. It was very comfortable, very quiet. So I was really excited about getting the new 2020 Santa Fe so I could do a little, you know, real hands-on comparison, because here's a guy who's really driven one of these things, and now I get to drive a new one and see what it's like. And I got news for you. This one is just as comfortable, just as quiet, with all the bells and whistles, as the old one. And it was such a pleasure. It was such a pleasure to be able to get in, drive it around, and really see the things that they had done, but really feel that the car, for all of the good things that it had back when I had one, 2008, that it still has all the really good things as the basis for the vehicle. The one thing they've changed about the new one that was not true of mine. Mine had a six-cylinder, and we sort of talked about this, I think, in one of the last things we talked about, but in my Ford Edge, which I bought after the Hyundai, it has a six-cylinder. And I liked the six-cylinder. And it was the gas mileage about 20 miles to the gallon on the highway, especially. Maybe 17 around town, that kind of thing. But that was fine. I mean, gas wasn't as expensive, I don't think, as it is now. Mm-hmm. But I just felt like I had plenty of pickup and plenty of get up and go and hauling and carrying a bunch of stuff. And if I needed to carry people, I'd put the seats up and put four guys in. We'd go out to supper and all that. And I just felt very comfortable with that. The 2020 has a four-cylinder, and it's got the turbo. It's, the fuel economy is good. I don't have the paper in front of me. Lori may have it, but it's like 22 miles average.
Average.
Yeah, 22 yeah. miles per gallon average. So it's on the highway,
the city,
it's
26 on the highway.
It is.
Yeah.
26 highway,
yeah.
20 city, 22 average.
Right. That's what I thought.
Yeah.
And but I would rather have more power than the four-cylinder turbo. I'm not a big – that's a pretty good-sized vehicle for a four-cylinder, even with a turbo.
Mm-hmm.
And I would just be more comfortable if I had more horsepower. This is, I think, 200. And it's a 2.0 liter turbo engine. I'd be more comfortable, personally, if I had a six-cylinder in it. Don't ask me why. Maybe it's because I'm used to it, but I just really feel like that would be better for overall for the feel of the vehicle when you're on the highway. It's when I was growing up, we used to, when you had a lot of straight shifts and stuff, and, you know, if you missed a gear, the engine would, what we called lug. You heard of lugging the engine when it just sort of, it's not really at full power and it's struggling to keep up. And I just felt like on the highway with the new one, the new 2021, that occasionally you get it about 50, between 50 and 55, if you've got three people in the vehicle, some gear and some of that kind of stuff. It's just like, yeah, I'm making it, but it's sort of a struggle. And I don't like that feel in a vehicle. So that's why I would opt for a six-cylinder if Hyundai would do it. Other than that, no complaints whatsoever. Now, compared to my old one, and now we'll talk about how it was like night and day, the old one was a really wonderful vehicle for its time. Now you get into it, I reach up above the rearview mirror, push a button, and literally, and Lori can talk about this, but literally the whole top of the truck, or whole top of the vehicle, opens up. Tell them about the sunroof, honey.
That was magnificent. It went all the way down, all the way back. You felt like
we don't even know where it went, do we? There was so much of it going away. We don't know where they put it all.
I don't know where it went, that's for sure. It gave the impression of being in a convertible. It was absolutely lovely. You know, you were talking about the things that, you know, your reservations about the power of the engine for a vehicle that large, honey. But I got to tell you, and it's not just on the Hyundai, it's on everybody these days, and it's just gotten to be like fingernails on a blackboard for me, and that's that idle stop and go.
When you stop, come to a full stop, the engine stops. And then when you take your foot off the gas, it starts up again. I don't like that at all. They have put switches in there, you can turn it off, and the Hyundai had one. It was down right next to your right hand, right next to the gear shift. You just turned off the automatic stop. But, yeah, I can't understand how that's supposed to be more efficient. Starting a car is what I always understood was what used the most fuel, turning the car, getting it to start. Well, if that's the case, why are we starting it 10 times when we're out and we come to stoplights and everything? Some of this doesn't quite make sense to my old logic anyway.
You know, we can and we will go through the list of what this vehicle has, but I want to pick up on something that we said last week when we did the review on the Hyundai Sports Sedan, and that was this vehicle, this is terrific, this vehicle fully loaded is $39,200. Now, there are options. There is an option.
And we have it. We have it on this. This is really top of the line. What is the option?
Really?
Yeah.
The option for $135 are carpeted floor mats.
Everything we're going to talk about
that's the only
is included in this vehicle for $39,000. It's unreal.
And here's the thing that we brought up last week when we were discussing what we were going to talk about this week, and that is we talked about the, you know, Hyundai Sports Sedan last week. That vehicle came in at just under $30,000. This vehicle's coming in at $39,000 plus delivery, which is $1,000. And the difference, for $9,000, you get like like a mega vehicle. You get three times the vehicle with 10 times the perks. I mean, and it's interesting because the only time we've ever said anything derogatory about Hyundai, except for what you just mentioned about the engine, and that's not really derogatory, but that was, you know, our confusion over this sports sedan that Hyundai came out with, even more so when we realized for just $9,000 more, you get a vehicle that we would love to own. I mean, this was a phenomenal vehicle.
You know, when you start talking about this one and you talk about the Palisade, I just don't know. For the money, it's to me, it's incredible what you get for that kind of money these days. Well, especially when you're talking about driving some of the other ones that we have driven and talked about that are $65,000 and $70,000 cars.
Now, interrupt you, Johnny, because here's another thought. You know, we always talk about how we're Hyundai's greatest cheerleaders, and it's pretty true. But didn't you say that they're now hosting, is it Monday Night Football?
Yeah. Yes. In fact, Yeah, that's one of the interesting things of Monday Night Football, because I told Lori that the Palisade, I think it was the one that they were featuring in all of the commercials. And I thought, Hyundai's on top of things. You got Monday Night Football, and you're touting the Palisade. You got a lot of people looking at your commercials. That's pretty good thinking.
Now, let's talk about Hyundai just as recently as a decade ago. It's just not even the same company, is it?
No. Hyundai put some money into Kia so that they own 20%, I think it is.
I don't mean it that way. It's just a whole different – I mean, it's like it's gotten like a – testosterone injection or something like that. I mean, it's...
Yeah.
I think they figured out... The Santa Fe, which we still need to talk some more about, but the Santa Fe was one of, if not their best-selling vehicle when they came to this country. And if you remember, the Ford Edge, about the time I bought it, was the number one car in America. Everybody was moving to those SUV-type, crossover-type vehicles. And so Hyundai shows up with a Santa Fe, right size, right capacity, right number of seats, you know, right leg room, right comfort zones, all those kinds of things. And it was a really, really popular vehicle. And they say that it's, you know, was the biggest thing. Well, that opened the door. And with the American market, who's the biggest consumers on the face of the earth? We are. I mean, let's be realistic here. You want to buy something. You know, Americans can buy anything. We can't sell crap, but we can buy a lot of stuff. And so Hyundai has started marketing then to the American audience. And that big safety thing, I've talked about this 100 times, but when you had the 6 cars in a row and they all stop, the drivers get out and the cars keep going, and they all stop one behind the other. That big safety thing, when they started that, and all the other car companies really got on board. Maybe they were ahead of them, I don't know, but the only one I remember starting it was Hyundai. And the safety features that they keep adding to their vehicles, and it really keeps them on the edge of not only comfort and quality and safety and price, which I don't know what else you're looking for in a vehicle. So I think they've done a really good job. But you're right, they've come miles since they started here.
Now, here's an interesting question, she said, and that's this. Here you've got Hyundai, and others who are coming out with these incredible price points. The competition, well, they look at this and they realize, and we're seeing this, that they've got to stay within those price points themselves. And some of them are not used to, you know, whittling away the bottom dollar. And it's leaving very few car makers who can carry on with, a higher price point just on the strength of their reputation. And I'm not even so sure that includes companies like Mercedes anymore. I think that we're seeing a new price point being set. I'm not making this very clear, but...
It's going to hurt the American manufacturers is what you're saying.
And some of the Europeans as well. Because
right, BMW. Mercedes, that kind of thing.
And this is why Hyundai can afford Monday Night Football ads. It's because they're selling a ton of cars, because people are realizing, my gosh, for this money I can get this car with all of this, and then they go to an American or European manufacturer that they're used to buying, that they may even have product loyalty with, and they say, but gosh, kind of the same thing with not as much to offer is costing $5,000 or even $10,000 or more. And I think mm-hmm. that now the stage has been set for a whole big price war, if that's not already happening. Now, of course, you get into, you know, some of these luxury brands like Rolls-Royce, and you don't, you know, anybody who can afford a Rolls probably doesn't give a hoot about what it's going to cost. But, you know, for people that are, you know, not in that, even, honey, what was...
You never ask a question, by the way. You said, that asked this question. And then you started talking, and there was no question in there. So,
yeah, here's
so Hezzy and I are sitting here thinking, what are we supposed to say? Because there's no question to answer.
Yeah. And here's another question,
thank you,
honey.
Yes, dear.
When we were at the post office quite a bit ago, and there was it a Ferrari, that red car? And the guy gave us the catalog?
No, that was a no, it wasn't a Ferrari, but keep going.
What was it? It was a big luxury name, and the car was selling for like $60,000, and we were incredulous about it.
Right. Yeah.
And, oh, we've got to remember what that was,
maybe,
because
maybe it was a Giulia, you know, from. No. Italian? No.
Okay. If you said the name, I it's something that would be.
Was it a Maserati?
It might have been. Might have been a Maserati. It wasn't a Lamborghini, but it was in, you know, mm-hmm. it's one of those kinds of names that if you say it, people go, oh, wow, look at that. But yeah, it was $60,000. I thought of the Porsche Cayenne, which you're familiar with, Laurie, but when they came out with that and how popular that was, it was very expensive for an SUV type, but it was a Porsche and it wasn't $80,000. Right. It was only $60,000 or whatever it was. So all of a sudden you're getting a Porsche and you're getting a bargain. And if you remember one of the commercials, the guy's standing at the back of it with the engine running, and he's holding the phone down so his friend can hear how wonderful the engine sounds while it's running. And then he goes, yeah, it's a Porsche, you know, and it was the SUV type of thing. Clever marketing, I think, and again, moving toward that concept that more and more people seem to want. I told Laurie the other day, I did an informal survey, just going from here to the grocery store, to the post office, to the doctor's office and back. And I was just looking at how many cars are SUVs or crossovers as opposed to sedans and other things. You know, if you look at the crossovers, the SUVs, and throw in pickup trucks, you know, it's well over half of the cars on the road to me. See, that's, again, it's an informal survey.
SUVs,
did you pull up and look around, and that's what you did? Yeah, well, that's what I said. That you throw in pickup trucks down here. Yeah, you throw in pickup trucks down here. You got it. Yeah, you got half the people on the road. So it's a very popular design right now, for sure.
But like, it's also causing. Sorry, go ahead.
No. You go ahead.
Go ahead.
Well, I was concerned because there's so many SUVs, and let's face it, I don't think that people use it all that time. You know, considering all that extra space, but it really is detrimental to our, you know, to the ecology, you know, the amount of energy that's used, you know, to power those things is really high, but people love the design. It is, you know, but how many times have people really used a vehicle for its purpose? That's the question.
As we said very recently, a car has become our home office, place we spend a significant amount of time each day stuck in traffic jams or ferrying kids to soccer games or whatever.
So we're anticipating a lot of the things that we would need a vehicle
for. You're right.
And putting it into
that
vehicle. And I think that's why it's so popular, because it covers so many of those things that we do. I can't get away from here without – I have to talk about the safety issues, or not issues, but the safety things on the vehicle. Stem to stern, it has all of the bells and whistles keeping you out of an accident. Honey, you've got the sheet. You just read them off. I mean, it's pretty simple and straightforward, but they always include all of them.
It has, and again, all of this is included. It has a forward collision, avoidance assist, safe exit assist.
Now, that's one of the new ones. That's where if a kid's in the back seat and he's getting out to go to school and he can't open the door, and he's like, hey, what's the matter with the door? Because the car is sensing whether there's an oncoming vehicle in the lane next to you and won't let you open the door into an oncoming car. Been a couple commercials on
fantastic.
That. Yeah, really well thought out idea. Certainly. Keep going, honey.
Blind spot collision avoidance assist.
Yeah.
High beam assist.
Yeah.
Rear cross traffic collision.
Right.
Avoidance assist.
One of them is to stop if somebody walks in front of you.
Yep.
You've seen commercials of that. The other one's if you're backing up somebody or something comes behind you, it stops your car. Yep. Go ahead.
Lane keeping assist.
Yeah. Get in the middle of the road.
Yeah. Oh, gosh. And that car was really good because I would drive it. It would put me right back in the middle. I could feel it.
Yep.
Attention warning, blind view monitor.
Now, the attention warning is an interesting one. That's a relatively new one, too, which is now it's got a camera monitoring you. Hey, you, wake up. It's like, yeah. Oh, that's good. That's a good thing. But
yeah,
you know.
Great.
Smart cruise control with stop and go.
Yeah, that's the one you don't like. I don't.
Surround view monitor.
That's an interesting one because I'm always wondering, where's the little man who's up there on top taking this picture around the entire car? That's a hard one for me to figure out. So.
Ultrasonic rear occupant alert.
Can't leave the kid or the dog in the car anymore.
Yep, it's going to tell even.
Yeah, it's going to beep and it's going to get on your phone. So.
And it's going to also tell you if you left some groceries in the backseat.
Yeah.
And then parking distance warning and reverse.
Yeah. Yeah, that's just when you back up, it not only warns you can see what you're doing, and it gives you the red lines as you get close to something, but now you also have a warning.
Now, because this is such a new vehicle, being the 2020 year, we don't have any government 5-star safety ratings yet on this vehicle, so we can't tell you. But I can't imagine it would be anything less than stellar. It's just, it's a solid, solid vehicle.
One thing that... I don't think they even mention it, which I thought was interesting. I didn't see it in the list anywhere. But if you remember when we had the Palisade had the tachometer and then it had the speedometer. And if you turn left, the tachometer, which is to the left of the center in front of your steering wheel in your dashboard, the tachometer would become a camera to show the left side of the vehicle when you turn on the turn signal. Mm-hmm. And the speedometer on the right side would also turn into a camera and show you the right side of the vehicle if you were turning right. On the Santa Fe, when you turn on the signal, the speedometer, which is the big, is the only thing in the middle, really, good size, in the middle of your dashboard, front of your steering wheel, or your display, rather, in front of your steering wheel, if you turn on the left signal, the whole left side of the vehicle is in a camera. It's showing you what is to the left of you as you're turning left. If you turn on the right-hand turn signal, the whole right side of the car shows up in the middle in front of your steering wheel.
It is so way cool.
Yeah, it's the thing I like about it. And you never think about these, but if you're trying to make too short of a turn, you're going to see the things that you're about to run into. The bushes, the mailbox, the stakes in the ground. You know, I think that it's again, it's very innovative. Never seen it on another vehicle. I haven't seen it on vehicles so far. But it's one of those innovative things that Hyundai comes up with that just makes it a little easier and better for you to drive. And so I applaud them for all these things that they've done.
So, one thing, back to what we were discussing before, you know, when we were saying, well, you know, your car may be more car than you need all the time. It's the mindset, isn't it? When you buy a four-wheel drive car, you think that, you know, okay, I'll go off-road, I'll need to engage four-wheel drive, but you're not driving in four-wheel drive all the time. It's just an option. Right. Again, it's the way we look upon how cars not only fit into our lives, but are increasingly taking up more and more time in our lives and in some ways controlling our lives. But, you know, we talk about the safety features and how they are so innovative and increasingly innovative and increasingly indispensable. I mean, when we look at a car that was made 10 or 15 years ago and it doesn't have these new electronic features and the stop and go and this and that, you know, you miss them. You really do miss them. And so...
We're about out of time, and I want to address something you're talking about.
Okay.
Maybe at a future thing, but this... And Hezzy brought it up about the use of resources as far as our natural resources and the impact we're having on the environment, those kinds of things. Yes, cars are very important to our lives. To younger people, I think there could be a very nice discussion. To younger people, many of whom work from home, many of whom are computer-oriented, many of whom do not have long commutes, many of whom have grown up using Uber and some of the other types of things, having a vehicle is not nearly as important as it was when we were growing up.
Oh, but guess what? You know what I started realizing? I didn't set it aside and I have to look it up again. It turns out the younger people, the millennials, they're starting to buy cars again.
So really?
They're changing. And I don't know the rationale for it. So what we used to think was like a dry spell, it's evidently coming back. And it's very conceivable that the SUVs, compact and larger SUVs, are the reason that they're coming back. Maybe it's becoming more utilitarian, and we needed that all along.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Well, it'll be very interesting to see.
It is very interesting because the smallest percentage of new driver's licenses is actually that age group, and it'll be interesting to keep our eye on that and see how that can reflect with new drivers. Well, on that happy note, Hezzy, please stay dry. Don't get blown away.
I will.
And we will see next week.
We don't know what we're talking about next week because we haven't gotten a new car yet, have we?
Well, no, but we've got a few that we have driven that we haven't talked about, and so we'll go through.
Don't worry. We'll have one to talk about for sure.
Plenty to talk about.
Absolutely.
Have a great week, Hezzy, and to all our listeners.
Thank you, Hezzy.
Goodbye now.
Thank you, John. Thank you, Lori. All the best. What a pleasure. Thank you very much. Well, it doesn't get more exciting than the driving me crazy crowd. You know, it's at one time I used to think, oh, my God, driving me crazy, that's so perfect. But they don't drive me crazy anymore, do they? Anyway, so let's take a quick break. But I know what's going on in our neck of the woods. And it's always a pleasure to have Lori and John talk to us about the vehicles that they drive. You know, it's really interesting. Didn't have enough time, unfortunately, for their time slot. What I find interesting is that when we talk to Lori and John and Lori, what's fascinating is that they've driven vehicles, not just this one time and spent a week with a car, but they have the capacity because they have the experience of having driven so many of the same brands all along their long time span of being automotive reviewers. So they literally go, you know, 30, 40 years back, and they can tell you about all these cars and all these trucks. And that's what makes it so unique, because they have a perspective that goes back not just to this year's model or last year's model, but decades back. And it's so nice to be able to reflect and say, hey, they were really terrific then, but they're just as terrific now. But they have all these extra accoutrements that make them safer, make them innovative. And that seems to be the place where innovation is taking place. Question of safety, security, and so on and so forth. And gas mileage and other things that are happening. But it's all the technology that's really becoming a very important and integral part of the new automotive industry, and very, very compelling. And it's going to be very interesting to see where we go. But it looks like we're constantly heading to higher and higher levels of accomplishment and expertise and in manufacturing as well as in technology. Just really, really fantastic. Well, let's take a quick break, find out what's going on in our neck of the woods, and then we'll be right back to do some international and national news. We'll be right back.
The Yonkers Tribune, named Home of the Acid-Tongued Bloggers by the New York Times, is a multifaceted news organization dedicated to keeping the citizens of Yonkers and Westchester informed via the internet and radio. Hezzy Aris is the tireless publisher, editor, and radio host of the Yonkers Tribune. He is a balding, bearded gnome, equipped with a digital camera and a stenopad at all times. Hezzy is frequently spotted in local meetings, translating the events into a Baroque prose style with an infusion of well-mannered outrage. The Yonkers Tribune attracts an informed, well-educated, affluent audience who hungers to know more about politics in all its permutations and nuances. Politics, says Hezzy, is our forte. Advertising inquiries are always welcome. Please call Hezzy Aris at 914-562-0834 or send an email to ehezi@hush.com.
Well, the Younger Tribune has really tried to streamline some of its communication capacity. So we've gotten a new number, and that new number is the office number. It's the cell number. It's also the voicemail number, and it's also the text number. So one number for all those possibilities, 347-415-4326. So again, the number is 347-415-4326. Now we have a moment. Let's do a quick introduction to the broadcast. And so listen in again with regard to this.
Welcome to Blog Talk Radio. This is Westchester on the Level with your host, Hezzy Aris.
So I always keep forgetting to do that because I'm so enamored with doing the first segment, which is the Driving Me Crazy introduction. So I keep forgetting to do that after we finish it. Well, I guess the most important thing that came out that will affect a great deal of what's going on here in the United States, of course, is unfortunately the passing of a very big figure in Congress. It seems that Elijah Cummings has died at the age of 68. So Maryland representative means he's a member of the United States Congress. Representative Elijah Cummings, he's the Democratic chairman of the House Oversight and Reform Committee. He's a key figure in the impeachment inquiry of President Trump. He died today of complications from an ongoing health issue. That's what his office announced, and he was 68. It seems that at approximately 2:45 this morning, October 17th, Congressman Elijah E. Cummings, who represents Maryland's 7th District, passed away at St. John's Hospital due to complications concerning longstanding health challenges. That's what his office said in a statement. Now, Cummings, who had been absent from Capitol Hill while under medical treatment, had suffered from health conditions in recent years. His office didn't detail what procedure he underwent. In 2017, he underwent an aortic valve replacement, a procedure used to correct narrowing of the aortic valve in the heart that his aides said was minimally invasive in Cummings' case, according to the Baltimore Sun. And the operation led to an infection that kept him in the hospital longer than expected. And later he was hospitalized again for a knee infection. But he said this summer that his health was fine, according to the newspaper. Well, the president sent his warmest condolences to Cummings' family and friends Thursday morning. Quote, I go to see firsthand the strength, passion, and wisdom of this highly respected political leader. Or he says, I got to see it. And his work and voice on so many fronts will be very hard, if not impossible, to replace, Trump wrote on Twitter at about 9 in the morning. A very magnanimous statement by President Trump. I hadn't heard one like that in a long time. Anyway, Cummings, who had represented Maryland's 7th Congressional District since 1996, had not taken part in a roll call vote since September of 11th of this year. So on October 4, he subpoenaed the White House for documents related to the House impeachment probe after administration officials failed to comply with repeated requests for the materials related to Trump's efforts to pressure Ukraine to investigate former Vice President Joe Biden and his son Hunter. So in addition to his committee, two other House panels are leading the impeachment investigation: the Intelligence Committee, chaired by Representative Adam Schiff, and the Judiciary Committee, chaired by Representative Gerald Nadler. And such sad news this morning at Representative Cummings was his friend and a giant of public service and the U.S. Congress, his presence, passion, and morality, clarity. Will be missed, and my heart goes out to his family and constituents. That's what Gerald Nadler said in a tweet. Schiff also called Cummings the heart and soul of our caucus, a dignified leader with a voice that could move mountains. He was our moral and ethical North Star. In his tweet, he added, "Now we will be guided by his powerful memory and incomparable legacy. Rest in peace, my friend," he said. Sharecropper's son, the former Maryland state delegate and trial attorney, was a formidable orator who passionately advocated for the poor in his black majority district, which covered a large portion of Baltimore as well as more well-to-do suburbs. In 2019, Cummings became a national figure as chairman of the House Oversight and Reform Committee and became a thorn in the president's side, with Democrats assuming the House majority after the 2018 elections. He won the ability to demand documents related to Trump's personal finances and policies, as well as possible abuses at federal agencies. Trump responded by criticizing the Democrats' district as a, quote, rodent-infested mess where, quote, no human being would want to live, end quote. His comments came weeks after Trump drew bipartisan condemnation following his calls for Democratic congresswomen of color to get out of the U.S. right now and go back to their broken and crime-infested countries. Well, Cummings fired back that government officials must stop making hateful, incendiary comments that divide and distract the nation from its real problems, including mass shootings and the scourge of white supremacy. And those in the highest level of the government must stop invoking a fear, using racist language, and encouraging reprehensible behavior, he said in a speech at the National Press Club. And Cummings said he had just a single one-on-one conversation with Trump, and that was in 2017 when both were working on plans to lower prescription drug prices, according to the Baltimore Sun. He recalled saying, quote, "Mr. President, you're now 70-something. I'm 60-something. Very soon you and I will be dancing with the angels. The thing that you and I need to do is figure out what we can do. What present can we bring to generations unborn?" And Cummings said he then told the president that we don't need to be doing mean things. We don't need to be doing or to just represent 30-something percent of the people that like us. We need to represent all the people. And Cummings, who was born in 1951, was one of seven children of Robert Cummings Sr. and Ruth Elma Cummings, who were sharecroppers on land where their ancestors were enslaved. The couple moved to Baltimore in the late 1940s. As a youngster, Cummings struggled in elementary school and was assigned to special education classes. But after showing promise in high school, he earned a Phi Beta Kappa honors at Howard University in Washington. He received a bachelor's degree in political science, graduated from the University of Maryland School of Law, and passed the state bar in 1976. In 1982, Cummings ran for state delegate and won, served in the Maryland General Assembly for 14 years and became the first African-American in state history to be named Speaker Pro Tem. Well, in 1995, he decided to run for Maryland's 7th Congressional District after Representative Kwesi Mfume announced he would resign to lead the NAACP. He was elected to office in 1996. The Baltimore Archdiocese tweeted that Cummings, quote, generously shared his God-given gifts and talents with the people of his beloved city, state, and nation for so many years. We give thanks to his dedicated service and pray for the repose of his soul. My God, what a giant of a man. And amazing from the simplest of lives. Very, very just compelling, to say the least. Now, let's just see what else is going on in our neck of the woods. One thing that was totally unexpected, but certainly made a big impact, is the fact that Juncker, from Luxembourg, now defends the Brexit deal and rules out a further extension. Listen to this report from Frans van Katte, because that's when Juncker and Johnson said that Britain and the European Union had agreed to a new Brexit deal hours before a new summit in Brussels. Where there is a will, there is a deal. We have one. It's a fair and balanced agreement for the European Union and the United Kingdom, and it is testament to our commitment to find solutions. I recommend that the European Union summit endorses this deal, Juncker had tweeted. Johnson also broke the news, tweeting that, quote, we have a great new deal that takes back control. We now he now has to convince the British Parliament to back it, although he has no majority there. After the announcement, Northern Ireland's DUP stated that its position had not changed and it could not support Boris Johnson's deal in Parliament. So listen to this report. We'll find out in a moment. Bear with me. We'll wait for this to, just to unfold. Let me see if we can get this. Looks like for some reason we're not getting the I'm not getting the audio yet. Okay, evidently we don't have it. It's not coming through. I'll try it one more time and see if it does somehow engage. No, it seems not. So But you get the gist. So we'll see if we can get some more information a little bit later on and just see how it's, what's happening. Well, let's first find out what the Irish are saying. Northern Ireland's DUP rejects the Brexit deal and threatens European Union talks optimism. Seems that Northern Ireland's Democratic Unionist Party, the DUP, announced Thursday it cannot support Boris Johnson's current Brexit plan, dealing a major blow to the British Prime Minister just hours before a crunch European Union summit. All things stand, or as things stand, we could not support what is being suggested on customs and consent issues, and there is a lack of clarity on value-added tax. The DUP, which backs Johnson's government, said in a brief statement on Twitter, we will continue to work with the government to try and get a sensible deal that works for Northern Ireland and protects the economic and constitutional integrity of the United Kingdom. The statement was seen as a major setback for Johnson, who would most likely need the support of his DUP allies in Parliament for any deal agreed in Brussels. It came as British and European Union negotiators worked late into the night in the hopes of presenting a last-minute Brexit deal to leaders meeting for a European summit. Both sides said they were close to finding a basis for a treaty to ensure Britain heads for a managed withdrawal from the European Union bloc. It has been parked for nearly half a century. But officials had to iron out details on how Northern Ireland, which is part of the United Kingdom, would remain under the European scheme for sales tax. The pound fell 0.5% against the dollar and the euro within minutes of the announcement. A pound was worth $127.59 and 1.1525 euros. Well, Housing Secretary Robert Jenrick told the BBC television, "We always knew these negotiations were going to be difficult and we're going to go down to the line." Asked whether Johnson could meet the DUP again on Thursday, Jenrick said that the Prime Minister and his team are in intensive negotiations with all parties, including the DUP. "We want to provide a sufficient comfort for the DUP and unionists in Northern Ireland to feel that the arrangements we would put in place with this deal are sufficient to give them comfort to support it." British politics expert Professor Tim Bale, BALE, Deputy Director of the United Kingdom in a Changing Europe think tank, said the DUP would struggle with any deal that created new divisions between the province and the rest of the United Kingdom, the antithesis of Northern Irish unionism. "It would be seen by some on their side as representing a surrender," he said. "They would have to explain what on earth the last 2 years have been about if they were to fold." And Johnson's governing Conservatives relied on the DUP's support for a majority in Parliament before a series of expulsions from the Conservative ranks last month left the government well short of a majority, even with the DUP's support. Mairead McGuinness, first vice president of the European Parliament from Ireland's governing Free Gael party, told BBC Radio, "Whatever optimism we had last night has been dampened a little." Quote, "It would be quite concerning if one political party can delay something or everything or have a veto over everything. The numbers in the House of Commons are very tight. It is of concern that one party is holding this up." So we're going to have to find out what all this means, and it's going to be very, very compelling, to say the least. So we're going to have to find out how all this stuff works. Now, let me just see if there's one other thing. It seems that the assumption here is that with regard to the Brexit deal, that the heads of state in Brussels will be relieved and will want to go ahead. Let's see if we can play this video for you, or if there's just a problem on our site for whatever reason today and it's not coming through. Okay, we'll give it one more shot, but it looks like our videos are not working for some reason. Okay, well, we'll just have to leave it at that. Now, this is a little bit frightening, actually very, very frightening. The Kurds are accusing Turkey of using napalm and white phosphorus. And it seems that the embattled Kurdish authorities in northeastern Syria today accused Turkey of resorting to banned weapons such as napalm and white phosphorus munitions, a charge Ankara has denied. Now, the use of such weapons since the start of the cross-border assault by Turkey and its Syrian proxies could not be confirmed independently. In a statement issued 8 days into the deadly offensive, the Kurdish administration said Turkey had resorted to their use because of unexpectedly stiff resistance by Kurdish fighters in the key border town of Ras al Ain. Now, the Turkish aggression is using all available weapons against Ras al Ain, the Kurdish statement had said, and Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan has so far ignored international pressure to halt the offensive, which has killed dozens of civilians and forced more than 300,000 people to flee their homes. Now, faced with the obvious failure of his plan, Erdogan is resorting to weapons that are globally banned, such as phosphorus and napalm, the statement had added. Turkish Defense Minister Hulusi Akar on Thursday denied the charges. Quote, it is a fact known by everyone that there are no chemical weapons in the inventory of the Turkish armed forces, he told reporters. He accused Syria's Kurds of using the chemical weapons themselves in a bid to blame us. Now, the Syrian Observatory for Human Rights, a British-based monitoring group with a wide network of sources or resources on the ground, could not confirm the use of napalm or white phosphorus. But Observatory Chief Rami Abdel Rahman said there had been a spike in burn wounds over the past 2 days, mostly casualties brought in from the Ras Al Ain area. Kurdish officials posted a video on social media showing children with burns, one doctor in Hasake province argued, are consistent with the use of banned weapons. Made notorious by their widespread use by U.S. forces in the Vietnam War, napalm and related chemicals are mixtures of a gelling agent and a volatile petrochemical used in incendiary bombs. White phosphorus can be used to create a smoke screen or as a battlefield marker, but it can also be deployed as a deadly incendiary weapon, a use prohibited under international law. A spokesman for the Syrian Democratic Forces, the SDF, the Autonomous Kurdish Region's de facto army, called on international organizations to send in experts. We urge international organizations to send their teams to investigate some wounds sustained in the attacks. And Mustafa Bali said on social media, medical facilities in northeast Syria lack expert teams, he added. So very, very frightening circumstances, should it be proven to be true. And who knows if it will or will not, but it's very, very frightening. Well, there are other things that are going on in Spain. The Catalan president has called for an end to violence and a new independence vote. So seems after calling for an immediate halt to the violent clashes that rocked Barcelona for a third day on Wednesday, warning that they were harming the image of the separatist movement, Catalan President Quim Torra had said there must be a new independence vote. As the Catalan capital echoed with the sound of sirens and masked youths staged running battles with riot police, Spain's acting Prime Minister Pedro Sanchez has made a direct appeal to Torra to, quote, clearly condemn, end quote, the violence. This has to stop right now, Torra said on Wednesday, his first comments on the violence. Quote, there is no reason or justification for burning cars nor any other vandalism. Protests should be peaceful. Quote, we cannot allow such groups to who infiltrate and provoke to harm the image of a movement which counts millions of Catalans, he added. Following day, Torra, Catalonia's pro-independence regional chief, reaffirmed his beliefs, saying a new vote would have to be held to decide on self-determination for the northeastern region, aiming for it to be independent from Spain by the end of 2021, if Catalan parties agree to it. Addressing the regional parliament, he also said he wanted to propose a proposal for a Catalan republic to be ready for the spring of next year. Torra added there was a false narrative that the Catalan separatist movement was violent. Earlier on Wednesday, thousands gathered for a protest called by the Radical Committee for the Defense of the Republic, CDR. But as the evening wore on, the situation cleared, became chaotic with hundreds running through the streets, hurling broken paving stones, lighting cars or torching cars, and occasionally stopping to take selfies in front of the burning barricades. This isn't violence, it's self-defense, roared a group of masked youngsters in front of a blazing barricade. And some even threw Molotov cocktails, the regional police said, with scenes of violence also spreading to other cities in the region, such as Tarragona and Lleida, prompting the Catalan leader to give a televised address shortly after midnight. Now, until Wednesday night, Torra had not made any movement on the violence that erupted on Monday, just hours after the Supreme Court handed down heavy prison sentences to 9 Catalan leaders for their role in the failed independence bid of 2017. Now, so far, Madrid has shown little appetite for taking matters into their own hands, despite the ongoing protests in Barcelona and elsewhere that have hit screens around the world as Catalan separatists have made their anger known. So the latest crisis began just over 2 years ago when Catalonia separatist leaders held a banned referendum that then issued a short-lived declaration of independence, prompting Madrid to sack its government and suspend the region's autonomy. Oh my God, it also put 12 of its leaders on trial, 9 of whom were condemned for sedition on Monday and handed prison terms of between 9 and 13 years. So earlier on Wednesday, as the crowds massed in central Barcelona, many began hurling toilet rolls into the air in response to a slogan by the movement saying, he was a lot of, there was a lot of shit to clean up, is the way they put it. So that's the story there. Well, I see it's 11 o'clock. I've got so much stuff to cover because of the meetings that were there, and I didn't get home till midnight last night. So it's just been absolutely outrageous what's been going on. So we'll call it a day. We'll quit for today and just advise you. I'm not exactly sure who's going to be on the program tomorrow, so we'll have to find out. Okay, and then we'll see what happens. All right, very, very good. So that's the story with us today. Have a great day, and we'll speak to you not on Monday because we'll be closed for a celebration of the giving of the Torah. It's called Simchat Torah. Mm-hmm. So we'll be closed on Monday and Tuesday for the holidays, which actually begin Sunday night. But we'll join you again on the 23rd. When we'll be speaking to Dr. Oren M. Levin-Waldman, and that should be a great, great discussion, that's for sure. So hope you'll join us next Wednesday. Until then, just have a wonderful day and take care of one another. That would be always a nice thing. And so let's go back to our studio screen and see if we can close down the show. Yes, here we are. So take care and thank you for being with us. Goodbye.